step on up, cowboy. You're inside the audio choke here at MMATorch.com. Thank you for downloading us via iTunes. Thank you for streaming us here at this fine website. And thank you in advance for writing a comment, positive one or negative. Just say something. Okay, well, only positive, I think. I'm getting a shake from Tobin. You know what? No comments whatsoever. Strike that last thing. And also, thank you for downloading us on iTunes, like I said, and Facebook and Twitter. Audio Choke at Twitter and Facebook.com. As always,
I'm Greg Rowland.
I'm Tobin Shelby.
And I'm Matt Collins. So, breaking it down, what do we got going on? What happened?
Well, let's see. A couple weeks ago, Fedor lost by submission, and this last weekend, Brock Lesnar won by submission, and the world doesn't make sense anymore.
Yes.
I mean, yeah. We all picked Brock Lesnar, but none of us picked Brock Lesnar by anything other than Donkey Kong pounding on the ground, right?
Well, to be fair, I didn't pick Brock Lesnar at all.
Okay.
Yeah, Matt went with Shane, which, you know, was a legit pick, because, I mean, while I did go with the Brock pick, I'm not going to be like, you know, I'm so smart, I knew Brock was going to win because it was 55-45. You know, there was no, that like really looked like he was going to be super dominant in the fight, which was evident, you know, kind of by the fight played out, where it's like, you know, the first round, Brock is just getting his face smashed in before he came back and wins. So all the people who picked against Brock looked like they were going to be right for a little while there.
Yeah, I can. That's Brock's next fight. I imagine when he's walking out and they give the three little info points about him. One will probably be takes a good ass kicking.
Yeah. Well, he knew how to be proud of his chin afterwards. He kept on like punching his own face a little bit. You know.
Yeah.
He was very happy to be able to take that ass whooping, which was just amazing. You know, he got clipped there at the beginning, and then for a whole 3 minutes, it seemed like he was just taking one after the other.
Yeah, and I mean, from my point of view, good job on the for the ref there to not because I think refs can be overzealous where it's like, oh, he's taking punches to his arms in front of his face, stop the fight. And certainly some of those punches were getting through, but I mean, he was still reacting and defending. And I was watching with a friend who basically thinks the fetal position covering your face is not a legitimate defense, and I'll fight that one for a while. I mean, like, covering your face is totally a legit thing to do when someone punches you there, so.
Yeah, so, but, yeah.
One thing that I've heard about this is that every time Rosenthal said for Brock to move, Brock moved. And I like that dialogue between the ref and the fighters.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you don't want for him to just stop the fight and for Brock to be, you know, to pop up and be, hey, you know, I'm okay. But at the same time, you don't want him to let the fight go on unnecessarily. So if you have the ref warning the fighter, be like, hey, you know, you need to do something because you can't let you keep taking these shots, and then the fighter moves, knows he's in there, he's still good. So I really like not only the reffing, but the play on Brock's part in terms of, you know, staying moving, staying, you know, not just absorbing. Like, he'll take some shots, and then Rosenthal will say something, and then he'll, you know, move around. He was kicking his legs a lot, and while he was absorbing a lot of shots, he wasn't staying in the same position the whole time. You know, there was some balling up in the fetal position, but there was also sometimes he was kicking away and was kind of like half mount or side mounted. So, I mean, while Brock was taking that ass kicking, it wasn't like he was just laying back and taking it. You know, he was certainly being active on the bottom, even though he was, in fact, getting his face smashed in.
Yeah, I do agree with that. I like the dialogue between a ref and the fighter on that. I mean, basically the ref saying, like, here's what you need to do for me to not stop the fight. Not, like, giving him coaching tips, but, like, hey, if you don't do something different. And, that's a good indication to show that, you know, the fighter who's taking the beating is, you know, head is still in the game, will still in the fight. I mean, that way they know, like, hey, if I don't want to keep fighting, I can just not do anything. So,
yeah, but I gotta say, like, all in all, I am more impressed with Brock after watching this fight than you know, I was before.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of questions about him, not only due to the sickness that he's had, but just, you know, because we've only seen him in a few fights and we've never really seen him in trouble other than when he got caught by the submission by Frank Mir. You know, he's always been on top. He's always been the bigger guy. So now he's the bottom for a while, and he's, you know, he's fighting the guy who's got the same strength as him. And he went and overcame adversity. So I got to say props to him. He earned the hell out of this win, as opposed to some but you can watch it and just be like, well, yeah, but he was, you know, he was bigger and stronger, big deal. And this one, you know, he proved that he was worth something. He took all that Carwin had to take, and, you know, Carwin is quite possibly the hardest hitter in the sport right now. You know, he completely dominated Mir and Gonzaga, who are some pretty solid wins, and then, you know, and then Lesnar made him quit.
Yeah, no, it was very good. And I was watching the fight with a few friends, including a few, I would say, Brock Lesnar haters, perhaps. And just for some of the reasons you mentioned before, you know, like one of my buddies was talking about, he's never been impressed with Lesnar because it always comes across as him just being the bigger, stronger guy, where his skill set hasn't necessarily been the thing that wins him fights just as much as him being, you know, this kind of large freak of nature. And, you know, I think this is, I mean, like, we were all really impressed watching it with, like, him actually pulling off, like, you know, a legit submission move. And we were like, oh, wow, that was good. And then, of course, his post-fight speech, I think, perhaps mended a lot of fences with some fans who were less than thrilled with his previous antics, so.
Well, one thing that I've noticed with Lesnar on that regard is he seems to treat his opponent the way he is treated.
Right.
You look back to Frank Mir, which is the most glaring example, obviously. And, yeah, he pointed and laughed at Frank Mir, who was laying on the floor bleeding. And, you know, he talked some serious crap afterwards. But, you know, watch his post-fight interview after fighting Randy Couture, who's known as being a very nice, respectful guy. And, you know, the first thing he said is, I want to thank God and I want to thank my opponent, you know. People kind of look at Brock as this jerk and, you know, the WWF guy who's playing the heel role. I really think it's maybe more of a case of, you know, Frank Mir kind of being a jerk, too.
Yeah, I think, yeah, that's a good point. I think it does depend on what he feels he needs to bring to the fight from the hype point of view. If someone else is going for a war of words, then he'll give back. But certainly, he does. Yeah, I used the Randy Couture thing as a perfect example when I was talking to some friends the other day about it. But and also, you know, he talked about his illness and thanking the doctors and everything. And, you know, we'll have to see, but it certainly seems like, you know, having come that close to, like, you know, losing his career and his health and everything, you know, maybe that might have affected his personality a bit as well. But only time will tell, I suppose.
Yeah, I could see how that would have a definite, you know, change on your outlook of life, where you're known as being this, like, super hardcore stud for your whole life, and then, you know, you're 30 and quite possibly on your deathbed. I could see how you would kind of change the way you look at things. And, you know, obviously he's come back and in impressive form 7 months later after he got cleared for you know, training again. He's defending the title in what many considered to be his toughest test in the UFC. And, you know, coming out with flying colors.
Yep.
So Shane Carwin, now have we figured out anything about him? We went into this fight not knowing anything about Shane Carwin, more so probably than Brock Lesnar, about, you know, what questions were answered by this fight and what's next for him and what does he need to work on?
Well, this is his longest fight ever, and it seemed to show that it did wear him out a bit coming out in the second round. He did seem a bit slower. I mean, he was really aggressive in that first round, and I don't know if he punched himself out or what, but, I mean, that was one of the questions, is how Shane Carwin fare if a fight goes longer than the first round. And, you know, in this case, it clearly didn't work out for him. He was, before he was able to stop some of the takedowns early on, and then, you know, come that second round, he wasn't didn't seem to be as on his game at that point.
Well, no, I think it's a little premature to say that Ben has gas issues.
It's over. Shane Carwin's over.
Yeah, for two reasons. One of which is when he stuffed that first takedown, that was already after he had hit Brock.
Mm-hmm.
So it's quite possible that Brock's takedown wasn't 100% because he, you know, he was perhaps a little off balance from, you know, being rocked a little bit. Because we don't really know, you know, like if Brock's equilibrium was 100% when he got that first takedown attempt in. And, you know, maybe having that minute of recovery helped him be more at 100% for the day. But also, you know, like, I don't care how much cardio you've done, how good of shape you're in, you punch a bag as hard as you can for 3 minutes solid, you will tire. So, you know, it could just be the fact that Carwin was overexcited and overexerted himself, and, you know, he could have tired himself out that way. Much like, you know, I've said this a number of times, you squeeze on a guillotine choke, I don't care what your cardio is, you squeeze on a choke as hard as you can for a minute, and your arm is going to be a noodle. And, you know, it can be the same thing with over-aggressiveness. You can, it can happen to anyone. That said, you know, we've kind of had that question about Carwin for a long time. So, you know, it's kind of up in the air still, but I think it's a little premature to say, oh yeah, you survived 5 minutes with Carwin and it's an easy win. It's not quite that level yet.
If Brock Lesnar can do it, anyone can, right?
I'm not sure how over-aggressive he was in the first one either. Like, it seemed any second there he could have just, you know, was so easy, so close to being just done, you know, knocking him out. So he just kind of smelled blood and he was going for it.
Yeah, I mean, it's no fault on his behalf. And, I mean, even if the fight had been stopped, it's not like anyone would have jumped up and be like, oh, you know, there's no reason to stop the fight there. There was cause to stop the fight. I've seen fights stopped for less. So, I mean, it's not like Carwin made a tactical error there, but, you know, he did burn an incredible amount of energy there. And doing so, he probably tired himself out. So, you know, if he was punching less aggressively, he wouldn't have had the chance for the fight stoppage, but at the same time, he probably could have gone on longer. So, you know, it's one of those kind of roll the dice kind of deals, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say. You know, it does depend with different refs, you know, when the fight gets stopped. And, you know, maybe Shane Carwin, you know, could have peppered his shots in more as opposed to just, you know, going all out like that. Or maybe, you know, backed off, get a stand up, because he was clearly outclassing Brock Lesnar on the feet. But, you know, it's just one of those, you know, hindsight's 20/20. I'm sure he'll definitely, this will be a learning experience for him. And every fighter says it, but they usually come back stronger, that sort of thing. And his first loss, it's probably going to be very formative for him. I mean, we also saw a lot of his, you know, one of the big questions is with wrestlers is how do they do off their back? And Shane Carwin, you know, was able to survive a bit when Lesnar was working that submission, but he didn't do much than others, than it seemed, you know, than just kind of wait until that submission got locked on. I don't know, you know, if he was waiting for Lesnar to get tired or what, but it didn't seem like there was a lot of defensive activity from Shane Carwin when he was on his back.
Yeah, I really don't know that he was ready for the submission attempt, though, either. You know, who knows how much he trained for that, just because, you know, I mean, nobody was expecting that to come from Brock.
Right. Which is an excellent point. It's probably a good reason why Brock Lesnar pulled it out there. And, I mean, if you got someone with his wrestling caliber and someone who's picking up the submission game, you know, he could be a lot of trouble for some guys that people before didn't maybe wouldn't expect he could be, you know, problematic to.
So, yeah, I mean, I wouldn't expect him to go in there and try and lock on a submission to, you know, say a Nogueira or a Mir or a Verdum should he ever make his way back to the UFC. But, you know, some of these other wrestlers, he's up against Cain Velasquez next. You know, who knows if he's got really any submissions or even a whole lot of submission defense on his neck. And, you know, it's quite possible he'll fight Junior Dos Santos after that. And, you know, there's another guy that he could very possibly submit if he's got a decent ground game.
Yeah. Well, I mean, since we're talking, you know, the future and stuff, I mean, how crazy is it that there's actually several potential fights down the line in the heavyweight division that are all very interesting? I mean,
yeah, this is the first.
Yeah, and it sounds like, I mean, it's confirmed that Velasquez is the next up for Brock Lesnar, and that's another exciting fight. I mean, I think it's a similar scenario to Shane Carwin in certain aspects, except for, I mean, Velasquez is a bit quicker on his feet. I like his stand up a bit more. I don't know how much the size will play an issue, and he definitely has gone, you know, the distance in fights. But another very interesting matchup for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of see that as being replacing the power with speed, and having a similar fighter after that. Because both of them are the wrestler that to do some stand up throwing. I've been very critical about Cain Velasquez's stand up power until his fight with Nogueira, where he knocked him out in something like, you know, a minute and a half. I forget exactly how long it took, but it was a pretty quick fight, and I mean, just dominated him. But then again, you know, at the same time, while Nogueira may have been known for his chin throughout the middle part of the decade, he's been less than impressive recently. So, you know, like, I don't want to take that away from Velasquez. I hope he does have some good striking power, but, you know, he's certainly, I mean, he doesn't have that power that Carwin has, so I think he's probably going to have a different strategy. more excited about this fight than the prospect of the Velasquez fight down the line. The one that really interests me is the one after that, where the winner of Junior Dos Santos against Roy Nelson is supposed to have the next title shot. And I think that'll be a fun fight.
Yeah. I would just, you know, from a fan perspective, you know, the dichotomy, if say, Roy Nelson gets that title shot, just the dichotomy of, you know, I don't know, it is 2010, probably 2011 by the time that fight happens, but it's still, like, we have the schlubby-looking guy versus, you know...
A brick S house.
Right, you know, born in a lab, created in a laboratory, Brock Lesnar.
Yeah. That's going to be really cool.
That would be quite the matchup if that ever comes together, you know.
It's the Greek god against the beer belly.
Yeah. But, I mean... Certainly, I mean, and Junior Dos Santos as well. Still, we haven't seen a lot of his ground game, but, I mean, again, you know, Brock Lesnar has several contenders vying for a shot at him that have good stand-up, you know, very clean stand-up. Maybe not the power that Shane Carwin had, but definitely very impressive stand-up skills. And, I mean, Roy Nelson would be a different bag of tricks altogether with his ground game. And
even he packs quite a punch.
Yes. Yeah, he might not look as pretty as some of the other stand-up fighters, but he definitely gets the job done when he connects, for sure. So plenty to look forward to. And I don't know, it was a crazy night. And how many wrestling friends did Brock Lesnar have at the fight slot the other night? Did you guys see? I mean, like, went into the crowd and, like, Steve Austin was there, Jim Ross was there. The Rock was there backstage.
Well, Jim Ross is a legitimate fan.
Good old JR, yeah. Well, I think most of those guys are probably legit fans.
No, they're not. They're fake fans.
I don't think they were setting up like an invasion angle or anything like that.
Yeah, that'd be funny.
But and Paul Heyman walked out with him.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Really?
Well, he's like his legit like friend/manager type dude.
Yeah, I picked him out of the crowd too. I was able to see his skullet. when they were hugging. You couldn't see his face from the camera angle, but definitely saw his hairline.
Yeah, so that was just weird, but not in a bad way. I was like, oh, that's my childhood coming back to
haunt you.
Yeah, you know. Whatever.
Yeah.
But what a crazy night, and I mean that was just the capstone, and you know even if that fight had not been what people had hoped for in this colossal collision of heavyweights, you know we still had. Some very, very crazy fights earlier on in the card. I mean, we got to talk Chris Leben, Yoshihiro Akiyama. That was insane.
Oh, definitely. Sorry to spoil this one for you, Matt. But that fight made my night, actually. I was talking on the last episode about how I was kind of mad at Akiyama for kind of playing the prima donna role, not necessarily even wanting to take the fight anymore after Vanderlei Silva dropped out and Chris Leben stepped in. And, you know, I mean, I was very happy for Chris Leben to, you know, go in there and take a fight on such short notice. You know, he just fought 2 weeks ago against a guy who is a relative unknown compared to, you know, some of the upper stars in the division. And he takes on this mega star from Japan who, you know, it's only his second UFC fight. And, you know, I've been talking about how, you know, Akiyama, you know, he's not this big star here. He can't play this prima donna role yet. And he ended up taking the fight and... You know, Leben was dropping some bombs, and Akiyama was, I mean, he was scoring some shots too, but really what he was doing most was, you know, he'd get his little judo trips in, and he was kind of just, there was a lot of laying on Chris Leben, and, you know, he was on top, but even on the bottom, Leben was scoring most of the submission attempts. There was the one armbar attempt by Akiyama that was really close and looked like it was about to finish the fight. But I mean, Leben was active. He was doing elbows. He was doing arm bars. All kinds of stuff, and, you know, you're just watching this fight and thinking, like, he's going to lose because he's spending so much time on his back. Even though he's being the aggressor, it's really uncommon for the guy who's on his back to win the judge's decision. And with 30 seconds left in the fight, triangle choke for Leben.
Yeah, it was insane. I mean, I think Akiyama really gassed out after that first round, and Leben wasn't looking like a, you know, that fresh either after, you know, later on in the fight, but I mean, he's known for it at this point. They showed in the highlight reels, you know, actually build it up as like a legitimate trait/skill of his that you know, even when he's taking damage, and you know, we saw it in this fight as well, not getting his hands up, not, you know, really throwing crisp counters or punches, he can take a lot of damage without going down. I mean, Akiyama, that second round, there was an exchange where both guys, you know, caught each other pretty good, and their hands were both dropped, and they both looked like they were two or three punches away from falling over. And me and my friend just burst out laughing because it was like this crazy exchange they both had. I mean, so it, especially in that second round, I mean, that was some great back and forth there with both guys just going blow for blow. And, yeah, I was pleasantly surprised to see Chris Lieben, you know, locking a submission at the end there. Everyone knows he has, you know, good ground skills, but we just never see it because it's not the type of fighter he normally tries to be.
Yeah, well, a lot of people forget about it because they are kind of few and far between. He usually does go for the knockout, and he doesn't really seem to have the best ground defense.
Right.
Because he seems to get cut in submissions a fair amount. I mean, his last loss, was it Jake Rushalt, I think it was?
Yeah.
I mean, he lost within the last year to a submission to a guy who's not a big name. So, you know, you kind of forget that he's got a ground game. But this is not his first submission win in the UFC either. He has an armbar win over, I think, Edwin Dewey's a few years back. But, yeah, I mean, just like you said, it's not the fighter he likes to portray himself as. And, I mean, it's certainly not his strength, but he's more well-rounded, I think, than he lets on.
Yeah.
And, you know, for him to get a submission win, especially against a judo guy like this, where you know the submissions in the ground game are certainly Akiyama's specialty. You know, that's essentially beating a guy at his own game.
Yeah, I mean, it was again pleasantly surprised, and you know, we'll see how he does going forward. I assume he actually gets some time off now, but I mean, he did call out Wanderlei Silva after the fight, and Silva's kind of benched right now with injuries to his knee and the ribs. So it might be a while, but I'd love to see that fight just from their, you know, because, I mean, Chris Lieben's basically got a very, very similar style with the stand and brawl.
Oh, that would be one of the greatest fights in terms of excitement, not in terms of rankings, of course, but just in terms of watching a fight and, you know, standing up and yelling at your TV.
Mm-hmm.
That would be one of the coolest fights ever. A recent thing I've just read today is Lieben is not only calling out Wanderlei Silva, he wants that fight, but he wants to coach Ultimate Fighter 13 against him.
Oh, of course he does. Yeah, I mean, that's a great way to build up a fight, too. And, you know, who knows if that'll come together. And, I mean, Chris Lieben's a pretty good character for reality television, clearly.
And a character from season one. He's still one of the most notable characters in the history of the show.
Yes.
And, you know, he's talking the entire fight about how he's such a great coach now, apparently.
Yeah, I mean, he's got a gym in Hawaii and all that. So, yeah, it'd be very interesting to see. I don't know, you know, how willing Dana White and the UFC would be willing to, you know. I mean, because Chris Lieben's, I mean, he's a fun fighter. He's been around for a while. But as far as, like, marketability goes, certainly he's got a highlight reel there. But, I mean, he's not like a, he's not a headline fighter at this point. I mean, certainly this, you know, after this, maybe he is. Who knows? I mean, he definitely put his name out there, and especially the 2 weeks between fights. I mean, he really, I mean, talk about a turnaround within the last year or so. But it interesting. I'd love to see the fight with Wanderlei, and, you know, if it's on the Ultimate Fighter, why not? But we'll see. Hopefully that'll come together. But again, I know Silva's out for a while with the injury, so Lieben might get another fight in between then if that were to come together.
Yeah. Well, I'd definitely like to see the Ultimate Fighter thing if possible. One of the reasons is just because neither of them are the champion or even a top contender, so
right.
It's not like it blockades the division for a long period of time. There are two guys who, you know, could in theory work their way up to a title shot, but aren't really a fight away from a title shot, so it's not going to constipate a division for a long period of time having them out for, you know, essentially 8 months between fights. And, you know, that would give Wanderlei Silva time to heal up. And, I mean, like you said, it'd be a good fight. Both of them are fairly likable characters, or at least characters that will get people to watch TV. Wanderlei Silva being probably the more likable of the two. But, you know, now that Lieben's cleaned up his act, I could see him being pretty likable. But either way, whether or not they get the show, which I wouldn't bank on it, should be an awesome fight if it gets put together.
Yeah. Definitely, I agree with that, and I mean, it is kind of funny, you mentioned Wanderlei Silva being the likable character, and just like a really big, you know, split between his in-ring persona, you know, the axe murderer, all that stuff, but, yeah, I mean, Chris Lieben's got this, you know, provided he stays on that path, you know, he's got this great kind of like, you know, turnaround story, you know, he used to, I mean, he was in jail for a bit, and he's doing drugs and drinking hard, and, I mean, his troubles are pretty well documented, and if he can actually, you know, have that turnaround. I mean, that's what reality shows are for, right?
Yes.
Yeah,
definitely. So what do you think this means for Akiyama?
You know, honestly, he's been in two fight of the nights so far. I think his UFC 100 bout with Alan Belcher was a fight of the night contender as well. Yeah, I mean, so and he got a win there. And they keep bringing up his popularity overseas in Japan and Korea, I believe. So, you know, I don't think he's going anywhere except for maybe a weight class difference, because he looks small against Alan Belcher and he looks small against Chris Lieben. And, you know, I mean, he was able to work a pretty good game in the first round against Chris Lieben. But I don't know, maybe a weight cut's in order, or, you know, work on his cardio or something. But I don't think he's going anywhere. I mean, the UFC seems to have invested in him as an overseas commodity, at least. But, yeah, I don't know. I mean, Chris Lieben's kind of the gatekeeper at middleweight there, and if you can't get past him, you have to do some reevaluating for sure.
Yeah, well, I mean, it makes me wonder if Akiyama is going to be in the UFC for much longer. I mean, certainly he's been putting on some interesting fights, but he doesn't seem like he's a title contender anytime in the near future. And given his status in Japan, I wonder what kind of a price tag he comes with. I'm not really privy to his payout information, so I wonder if he's really worth what he demands, or if he's demanding as much as he feels that he's worth.
Mm-hmm.
Unless the UFC is planning on using him for, you know, some sort of invasion of Japan, or an overseas card in the near future that would be in a place where he's a big hit.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the impression I've gotten, but yeah, it's really hard to say, so we'll have to see in the future. But I mean, he only got one loss in the UFC, and you know, that controversial win at UFC 100 for a lot of people, but you know, I'd expect to see him around for a few more fights at least. But yeah, I really don't know. I mean, maybe they'll set up the Akiyama Silva fight again, but you know, it kind of goes against the UFC matchmaking style. You know, they like to have winners fight winners, that sort of thing. So we'll see, I guess. Other than that, I mean, we saw Chris Lytle pull out another submission, which was weird, but shouldn't be unexpected, because he's kind of a submission machine, and everyone again just kind of forgets about it. But I mean, he's got 19 submission wins, so.
Yeah, well, he used to be a straight up submission guy.
Yeah.
And, you know, Matt Brown almost got the submission in that fight, too.
Yeah, it was crazy.
You know, I mean, almost doesn't count, especially when it comes to submissions. But, man, I mean, he had that choke in, and it looked like he was going to get the win. He was going to be the first person to put away Chris Lytle and Joe Riggs by cut several years ago, but just couldn't quite do it. And then I'm sure that wore out his arms. He had him in a Darce choke for a significant amount of time, and ended up getting caught by a double submission. It was like the reverse triangle and the reverse arm bar at the same time.
Yeah, it was pretty crazy, and again, very impressive. I mean, I think there was a lot more ground game than I think most people were expecting, you know, prior to this, you know, going into the fight, just kind of like the way these guys have fought, you know, recently at least. But, no, very impressive outing for Chris Lytle, and, you know, I think he's kind of solidified his position there in that division, you know, kind of being, I don't know if gatekeeper's the right word, because I think he's a little, you know, higher level than that, but just a guy who's obviously going to put on good fights, you know, seemingly win or lose. And, you know, who knows? I mean, he's on a three-fight win streak, and if he puts a few more impressive wins together, I don't know if he gets a bump up in competition or what, but, you know, we'll see. I mean, I'm kind of curious as to where he goes from here, I guess.
I'd like to see him get a bump up in competition, mostly because he's got at least his last two by finish. I think you fought Kevin Burns before that, but off the top of my head, I can't really remember how that fight ended up. I'm thinking it was by decision.
Yeah, he won a unanimous decision against Kevin Burns last June, and then this February he beat Brian Foster by a knee bar.
Yeah, so he's got two finish wins in a row, and he did a three-fight win streak. Give him a step up in competition. All I ask the UFC is, you know, just don't give him somebody passive, because, you know, that's not the fight that we want to see him fight in.
Right.
A fight that I'd love to see him go with, up up against is Dustin Hazlett, who is you know, another ground specialist, but also another just crazy submission who will, you know, go for really aggressive stuff. Not going to be an aggressive slugfest, but it has potential to be, you know, the Carlos Newton Sakuraba style fight where it's just two guys going for leg lock, arm bar, you know, choke, and then just back to back submission attempts.
Yeah.
That can be equally exciting as the you know, the Forrest Griffin Stephen Bonner style fight where there's just two dudes throwing bombs as fast as they can.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that would be a pretty fun matchup, and you know, interesting to see him take on someone who's got, you know, good ground skills like that, to see how he deals with that, if he'd keep it standing more, because, you know, in this past couple of fights he's been willing to finish on the ground. So I don't know, and certainly, you know, even in this loss, Matt Brown, I mean, he is kind of a, you know, a Chris Lytle type fighter. You know, I think there's always going to be room for guys like that in the UFC, guys who are willing to, you know, for better or worse, just really go out there and put on a show.
Yeah, well, and Matt Brown didn't exactly look bad here either.
No.
He did get finished, but, you know, he came close to being the first guy to finish Lytle in years. And, I mean, that is in itself is fairly impressive. Matt just couldn't put him away. Josh Koscheck couldn't put him away. So, you know, Matt Brown almost putting him away, that at least says a little something.
Yeah, indeed it does. Other than that, we had the Stephen Bonner, Krzysztof Soszynski rematch. This one actually getting a proper finish.
That would surprise the hell out of me.
Yeah, and, you know, for a while it was looking kind of like this first fight. It got a pretty sloppy at times. Stephen Bonner got cut up pretty bad. You know, honestly, I thought he kind of looked like Frankenstein a bit after the fight with the all the lacerations to his face and all that. But, no, he landed a pretty wicked knee and then finished Krzysztof on the ground. So.
Yeah, well, it looks like he turned it up in the second round. I don't remember exactly how it played out, but I remember him kind of scoring. Like, the first round, I was just watching him getting his ass kicked. And the second round, I was like, well, all right, he's doing a little something here. But, that, yeah, it was certainly a big knee where he turned it around. And, you know, that's really kind of a lot how the first fight played out, except it went longer before he turned it around, and then he just got cut. You know, the first fight, he got his ass kicked for two rounds and then was starting to come back in the third round was when he was getting his momentum. At that point, really, you know, he wouldn't have been able to win the decision anyway. He would have had to finish Soszynski off, but, you know, he looked out and got that cut, which, you know, of course he lost, but he got this rematch. He was able to avenge himself. I was kind of wondering a little bit about Soszynski's gas tank in this fight, though. He, you know, it might have just been some of the shots that he took, but towards the end of the fight, he looked a little slower. I don't know if he trained as hard for this fight as Bonner did. You know, and it also could have just been that Bonner pushed the pace more because, you know, he is known for his gas tank. You know, he's had all kinds of ridiculous war in the past. So that could have been one of Bonner's strategies, is to just go rowdy guerrilla style and drag this thing out and, you know, make Soszynski's heart pump through his chest until keep up with him anymore. But yeah, he landed that big knee and put him away, and props to him for making me call that one wrong.
Yeah, I mean, the thing with, and I guess now the question is, what do you do with Stephen Bonner? I mean, he's kind of shown in the past that he's not, you know, anywhere close to being, like, you know, a contender or anything like that, and, you know, I guess he's a good test for guys. You know, people need to say how good John Jones throws a spinning back elbow, throw him in against Stephen Bonner, but, I mean, he does put on entertaining fights, perhaps at times to his detriment, but, I mean, he did win this fight, but I don't know if we saw anything new, anything out of him that made me think, at least, that, oh, Stephen Bonner's, you know, on a comeback trail. It's just like, oh, it's Stephen Bonner out-punched this guy again, you know? I don't know where he goes other than the UFC just putting him in fights that are going to be, you know, fight of the night type of fights, you know, just potentially devolving into sloppy kickboxing, but very entertaining to watch at the same time, you know?
Yeah, you know, I don't think he really has to go anywhere. I mean, we could almost call him a light heavyweight version of Chris Lytle, except maybe not quite as good.
Right.
I mean, I can't remember the last time I've picked him to win a fight against a guy whose name I knew.
I thought he was going to beat Mark Coleman.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, fair enough on that one. Forgot about that, which was embarrassing.
Oh, goodness. I thought the internet was lying to me when I saw that he lost. Like that. Oh goodness.
Yeah, but I mean, as a general, like, I don't really think a whole lot of him in terms of skills, and you know, he's another one of those guys like Griffin who's really not blessed with punching power. So I mean, that was half of what surprised me so much of that he put Szczesny away in this fight. It's like, well, he beat him with strikes, huh? Crazy, because that's not really something that he's known for in terms of physical ability. You know, it's been years since we've seen Forrest Griffin put the way with strength. It's been quite some time since we've seen Bonner do it also. So, you know, props to him. I don't think he's ever going to get anywhere close to Shogun's belt or whoever it is at any given point. But, you know, keep him around. Dana White has publicly said he's never going to fire him.
Yeah.
So, you know, what the heck? Put him on the pay-per-view. He's a name. Even if it's more of a name than he deserves in terms of skills and in terms of actual accomplishments. But he was that guy who was at the right place at the right time. He fought the fight that the UFC needed at its most desperate moment, apparently. And so, I mean, he'll always have a job. And he does put on entertaining fights still to this day. You know, Forrest Griffin has gone with more of a technical route since then, but Bonner, you know, still is perfectly willing to slug it out even if it means he loses.
Right, and, yeah, I mean, that's really been the big difference between the two, I think, you know. I mean, coming out of tough season one, you're like, oh, these guys are fairly both, you know, kind of very similar fighters, and then, you know, just to see Forrest Griffin evolve through the years, you know, adapt his game, whereas Stephen Bonner really kind of looks like the same fighter he's always been.
Yeah, well, I think the big difference is a few of the losses that Forrest Griffin had, particularly the Keith Jardine loss, I think really changed him as a fighter. And, I mean, he really turned into a technician after that. He was sticking and moving. I think he realized that his opponents have a better chance of knocking him out than he has of knocking them out.
Mm.
So, you know, he was working for the out point, the out last, out cardio, and then, you know, do some grappling thing. He does have some submissions. He's not really somebody he's known for, but he's no joke on the ground, and neither is Bonner. You know, Bonner is also pretty underrated on the ground as well. But, you know, he'll be around. He'll probably be on the main card of pay-per-views. But, yeah, don't expect him to even really I wouldn't even really expect a huge step up in competition. Give him guys from The Ultimate Fighter. You know, if anyone from season 10 is looking to move down in weight, I'm sure Bonner would love to fight them.
Yeah.
Just give him Spike TV names for the rest of his career.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly wouldn't be surprised to see that. And then, you know, even with the loss for the Polish experiment, I don't think we're going to see Szczesny go anywhere. I mean, I think he's another good test for guys at light heavyweight. Just with, I think a lot of it has to do with his ground game, as you know, as well. He's you know, got a lot of you know, 10 submissions in his career, 10 submission victories. So I think he offers an interesting challenge for guys who have to prove, you know, who are looking to, you know, kind of prove themselves in the UFC, and he has put on some pretty entertaining fights as well. So yeah, I don't think we're gonna see Szczesny go anywhere immediately, and who knows what kind of fight he'll get next. But
yeah, one thing I gotta throw out there though that I like about this fight, as much as I dislike both of their names, both of them were representing a country in their nickname. This was the American Psycho against the Polish Experiment. So it was good to see USA win, just on that note.
National pride was on the line.
Yeah, I like to do USA chants whenever possible.
That's right, you know, Poland, you know, that just doesn't roll off the tongue well.
That doesn't work so well, yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, Poland sucks.
Yeah, I guess we haven't talked about it, but how excited are you guys for a rubber match, right?
Yeah, totally.
All right, well,
that's
what
we need to see.
Let's do this then. Let's start with what's a rubber match?
They've each won one.
Yes, so the rubber match is the third match between them.
Oh, yes. Okay.
They've won one and lost one each, so.
All right, against each
this
other.
This is the one to settle the score.
Gotcha.
I don't actually want to see that anytime soon, but down the line, I'm sure they can, you know, do it on the Fight Night main event or something like that.
What other cool fighting, you know, terms are there that I'm unaware of? Fighter slang,
you know? I really just want to start making stuff up now,
yeah.
To tell you.
And I'll just, like, use it on the podcast in the future.
Sure.
These completely wrong and fictional terms, you know.
Yeah.
That was an ice house right there.
Yeah.
That's when they spit outside the ring.
Yeah, that's it. Rubber match. That's all you're getting tonight.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. Rest assured, that is an actual thing.
You know what? I hadn't said anything in a while, to be honest with you. I just had to get my voice in here. So, all right, go back.
Oh, that's probably about all we had to say about that fight.
Yeah, there wasn't much else to say.
Cool post-fight pose by Bonner, though. What
yeah,
was up
he,
with that?
He was doing something, some sort of martial
arts.
He was
like, making a weird look at that camera.
Yeah. I don't know. Has he done stuff like that before, or is that just him being, like, a video game character?
It might have been a little bit of both.
Right.
Also, you know, a nice post-fight interview. That's another thing about Bonner, is that he's also, you know, once again, you know, drawing the comparison to Forrest Griffin. He's just like, you know, you put the microphone in front of him, and he's a likable enough guy. You know, he's just there to, like, make people happy for the most part, at his own detriment. And he was talking about how he's a sick bastard, apparently, for, you know, just wanting to go in there and get punched in the face a whole lot. And, that's cool, but makes the people happy.
Yeah, you know. Blood sport, hooray. I'm sure we'll feel bad about it 20 years from now when he can't walk straight or whatever, but you know, for now.
But you know what? We probably won't be hearing a lot about him then.
we just sweep the old guys under the carpet.
That's right, yeah. He'll just die in obscurity, Tobin.
Yeah.
Don't worry about it.
Under a bridge, homeless. Yeah. Not able to hold his own hands straight.
Merry Christmas.
Yeah. So how about that George Sotiropoulos guy, right? He's got to be in the mix for a title shot after they get that whole thing worked out after, Penn and Edgar fight again. And
I would say he is one solid fight away from a title shot.
Yeah.
The way I see the division playing out right now is obviously BJ Penn is fighting Frankie Edgar. There's no way around that one. That's set. And Ken Florian is fighting Gray Maynard, and that one is, for all practical purposes, a number one contendership fight.
Yeah.
The only way I could see that not happening is if BJ Penn wins and Kenny Florian wins. I could see the possibility of the UFC not wanting to do an immediate rematch, but I could also see them just being like, all right, you know what, you won three fights since you lost to BJ Penn, and he's not exactly, you know, he lost a fight since then too, so what the heck, you know, you've earned your regard, because, I mean, he looked very impressive against Clay Guida. He dominated Gomi. And if he beats Gray Maynard, who is, for all practical purposes, undefeated, you know, that's enough for me, and I think that'd be enough for a lot of people. But I could see, you know, because Dana White isn't a huge fan of rematches in a lot of cases, I could see where he would take that away from him. But George Sotiropoulos has put himself in a position where he is behind the winner of Gray Maynard and Kenny Florian.
Mm-hmm.
However, you know, that's two fights away for a belt. You know, like, the belt is going to be fought for twice in that time between the Frankie Edgar BJ Penn match and then the winner of that against the winner of the other fight. It's two fights for the belt. So Sotiropoulos is going to have to do something between now and then, whether he's going to fight the loser of the BJ Penn Frankie Edgar fight, or if he's going to fight a guy like, Tyson Griffin or
Evan Dunham.
Evan Dunham, that's right. He just beat Tyson Griffin, huh?
Yeah.
And Sean Sherk is, you know, another possibility. I know he's been out on injury for what seems like forever now, but he's still a former champ who is a big name. There's a few possibilities for him, but, he's got to be pretty damn close to that belt now.
Yeah, and again, it's got to be nice for the UFC to have someone lined up, you know, in theory that if they get just that one more win, you know, they've legitimately earned a title shot where the UFC doesn't have to scramble to try and elevate someone to that status who might not be ready for it. It seems like Sotiropoulos, you know, with that one more fight, it is there. And, they've got some stuff to work out in that division, obviously, but we'll...
Yeah, as fun a fight as this was, because I thoroughly enjoyed this fight, in all honesty, I kind of thought this was a step down from his last fight. It could just be a name value thing, but I kind of considered Joe Stevenson to be a bigger threat than Pellegrino. I mean, it might because people are more familiar with Joe Stevenson than Pellegrino. But, you know, like, I didn't think that Satoropoulos was going to get that win against Stevenson, and this one I pretty much considered to be in the bag as a result of the way that Joe Stevenson fight played out. That could have just kind of been the way I was looking at things. But I didn't see this as being a huge win. It's certainly a solid win, don't get me wrong, but this one I consider to be pretty expected at this point because I feel that Satoropoulos has kind of already proved himself.
Yeah, that's a good point, and I kind of agree with that that attitude there. And it was, you know, the only thing that kind of stood out to me was seeing George Satoropoulos kind of show off more of his stand-up game. You know, he got caught right towards the end of the bout. But other than that, he was really doing well, landing that left hand, you know, time and time again on Kurt Pellegrino there. And, you know, I think, you know, really rattled Batman's game plan.
Yeah. Satoropoulos, I'm a big fan of. I really liked him on season 6 of The Ultimate Fighter. I considered him really to be one of the favorites on the show. I was actually very surprised when he lost to Tommy Spear. I was, from the almost the beginning, expecting to see Satoropoulos against Max Danzig in the final, and Tommy Spear ended up ruining that for him. But, I mean, he has been nothing but impressive in the UFC since then. His first several wins kind of flew under the radar because they were against fellow Ultimate Fighter guys who were unsuccessful on the show. He had several submission wins over guys who were on the Ultimate Fighter, but, you know, didn't win, and you always got to take those guys with a grain of salt because, I mean, you can be a very good guy on the Ultimate Fighter and not win for whatever reason, but there's also a lot of guys on the Ultimate Fighter who kind of suck, but kind of end up in the UFC anyway, and, you know, they eventually wash their way out. But they get a fight or two that they may or may not deserve if they weren't the Ultimate Fighter veterans, just because, you know, they've got that name recognition from Spike TV, and, you know, your average fan does love name recognition. And, you know, I mean, for a while, George was in that position. Would he have even gotten the opportunity in the UFC that he got because you know, he was on TV? Who knows? But he has made the most of that opportunity, and a lot of the guys haven't. But, you know, when he had that Joe Stevenson fight that I'm going back to, that was a huge win for him. I mean, Joe Stevenson fought BJ Penn a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And, you know, he lost pretty spectacularly, but, you know, he's got some pretty solid wins on his belt. And, you know, George Satoropoulos just dominated him for 15 minutes.
Yeah, and I think the atmosphere of that fight really helped George Satoropoulos kind of, you know, come across as a big star because that was, you know, on his home turf in Australia. So he got a really big hero's welcome, you know, before that fight, and then during the fight there was chants for him and everything. So it really, I think, kind of gave him that boost. And, you know, obviously he didn't get that reaction during this fight, but, I mean, you could kind of tell, you know, people were definitely seemed to be more aware of him. He did get some good cheers and everything like that. So, yeah, it's again, I think we're going to see some big things out of George Satoropoulos coming up. You mentioned the Ultimate Fighter, you know, with George's experience on there, and so that's as good of a transition as we can get heading into the undercard fights, where I don't think anyone was surprised that Brendan Schaub beat Krish Tuxerer. You know, it was pretty impressive outing for him. Just landed a few solid punches, and that was the end of the night for Chris Tuxerer.
Yeah, I missed the prelims, but heard Schaub whooped his ass.
Yeah, it was about a minute, I think about a minute in or so, and just, you know, wobbled him, and I believe finished him on the ground, and yeah, I was kind of watching that while distracted, but yeah, he landed some heavy hits on him and put him away, and not much to learn from that fighter other than, you know, Brendan Schaub, you know, got another, you know, good win under his belt, and, you know, continues to improve, it seems, but we'll see how he goes from there. I think he's definitely coming off that kind of underwhelming talent season of the Ultimate Fighter 10, aside from, you know, Roy Nelson. You know, Brendan Schaub at least showed a lot of potential just with his size and his power and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
You know, still improving, definitely.
Well, you know, of the season of the Ultimate Fighter 10, yeah, there were essentially three people on that show to keep your eye on. And that's, you know, Roy Nelson, Schaub, and Kimbo Slice. And
yeah.
Kimbo Slice, gone. So, you know, it's Roy Nelson, the vet, and Schaub, the up-and-comer. And, I mean, there's a few more guys that are still around. Mitrione's still around. John Madsen is still around. But, you know, I'm not expecting big things really from either of those guys. And I think there's one or two other guys from the season that are still employed by people. But I don't think there's really a whole lot expected from them. The tournament really came down to the right two guys by the looks of things. I mean, it came down to the vet who belonged in the UFC really without even getting on the show in Roy Nelson.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no reason why he didn't deserve a job with the UFC just based on his resume. He probably would have gotten in either way. And then Brendan Schaub, who was the up-and-comer, the young prospect, who was undefeated and has some good knockout points, some pretty decent hands. He lost to Roy Nelson, but he looked good in the fight up until the point where he lost. He didn't just get blown out of the water. So, you know, he's still young. He's still a prospect. He's still learning. We could very well see big things for Brendan Schaub in the future. He's in the right division. Heavyweight has always historically been the weakest division in mixed martial arts. So, I mean, even if he never gets to the championship level, if he can just improve his skills to where he can get, you know, in contendership level. I mean, you've got a guy like Chet Congo who's, you know, he's not incredibly impressive in terms of skill set, but he's just big and he's good enough to keep a job and he earns payday.
Yeah, indeed. Other undercard fights, not a lot of deep thoughts on those for me, but, you know, Ricardo Romero taking it to Seth Petruzzelli with an armbar submission in the second round. I mean, that was a pretty crazy back and forth. I mean, Seth Petruzzelli really seemed to just tire out in that fight and just didn't have much to do on the ground, you know, once Romero kind of got control there. But, not too impressive for either guy. Romero was really getting beat up on the feet until he, you know, was able to win. So, not much for me to you know, talk about other than, you know, just seeing Seth Petruzzelli back in the UFC, you know, with his pink and black hair and, looked pretty decent until he lost and gassed out. And I'm not sure how bad he hurt his arm. It seemed like he might have done something to it.
Well, you know, I read a little interview with him since then, and I thought it was pretty interesting. Actually, he said that he does not deserve to be in the UFC right now.
Wow.
Given that he's 0-3 in the UFC, he feels that he needs to win another fight and then come back to the UFC, which is interesting. I've never really heard a fighter say something like that. Like, I don't deserve a job right now, essentially. Pretty humbling words, but, you know, he says that he gassed out. I didn't hear him say anything about his arm being hurt. So, I didn't see the fight, so I'm really not sure what you're talking about in that aspect. But I don't think he's hurt so much. But, yeah, he pretty much said he punched himself out.
Mm.
He felt that he had the advantage and he was working him, but he couldn't knock the guy out and lost his energy. And he even kind of said, like, the submission, like, he could have worked it out, worked out of it if it was earlier in the fight, if he had more energy, but he was hurt and his cardio wasn't up. Which is kind of a bummer, you know. It's always sad when, you know, it's like somebody's cardio is that big of a factor, especially in the second round if you're not a heavyweight. Did you catch the weigh-ins by chance?
I did not, but I don't think any midgets made an appearance. I think that might have gotten kiboshed.
No, I did watch the weigh-in. There was no midget, but
pint-sized brawlers? Or what was this in reference to?
Seth Petruzzelli was seeking some sideshow.
His own Joe C.
He actually had a midget with pink hair to come to the weigh-in. I guess the midget was backstage. And kind of a last-second thing, the Student Athletic Commission denied the midget stage time.
That's too bad.
I don't know how it would have played out. I don't know if the midget was planning on stepping on the scale or or what the deal was.
Yeah, I mean, that might have been too much of the sideshow antics, but, whatever.
I don't know.
It's weigh-ins.
Yeah, right? Like if Mayhem Miller can just throw his shirt on, you know. A ring girl, I don't know.
Well, that's just rude. I mean, that's not like bringing out.
Well, what are you saying that midgets aren't, you know, that are freakish? I mean.
No, I'm saying the guy he hired out had nothing to do with his fight, and he was just looking to draw attention to himself.
Show business.
it's a fight business, though. It's not show business.
And it also makes you wonder what he was planning on doing with the midget. You know, maybe if the midget was going to step on the scale, like, maybe that was the plan, and that would be, like, this huge issue. If the midget was just going to, like, in theory, be one of those corner guys, you know, I don't see why that would be a problem.
I know, hopefully that midget would have made weight.
Yeah, exactly. No, I mean, certainly if I was a fan of, you know, silly spectacles, whatever, but I could see how they definitely, the athletic commission would have thought, maybe this could be a little distracting.
Yeah, but whatever.
Yeah.
It was cool to see a way, and even though this one was not a, I mean, there was not really anything that stuck out. Nobody missed weight, and there was nothing nothing ridiculous that happened. Like the UFC 107 weigh-ins that we watched, where there was all kind of ridiculous stuff going on.
Hmm. Good point. So, in other news, Kendall Grove kept his job, we think.
Yeah, so, now, is this the fight where, Greg, you were, follow somebody on Twitter. You want to give us a little background on that?
Oh, really? There's not a whole lot to say there. My friends and I were watching this on delay. We DVR'd it, and so I was staying off the internet for quite some time.
Yeah, no spoilers, because that's what it's out there for.
Yeah, because I accidentally spoiled the Fedor fight against Verdum. Oh, man, that pissed me off. So that was the last thing I wanted to do was spoil the Lesnar Carwin fight. So I logged off of the Twitter right when the pay-per-view was going to go live. Because I didn't care about the prelims. I figured, you know what, if prelims get spoiled, that's not a huge issue.
Yeah.
I can deal with that. So I see UFC posts something saying, Kendall Grove has new facial hair. And that's all we can tell you about this fight without us spoiling it for you. And I'm thinking, they just made this big deal about the Kendall Grove. Something's gonna go down in that one, and nothing did at all.
Right. Now, wasn't it like Kenny Florian said, like, that was the craziest match ever?
You know, I mean, I couldn't even tell you that. I don't remember really anyone else mentioning it. It was just, I think it was the UFC who said, yeah, they just felt the need to single out that fight. They didn't say anything else about any other prelims. And, you know, when the show started, we noticed there was this huge blood stain on the man. Didn't know why. And, you know, that's always one of those kind of interesting things. Like, which prelim is that going to be that has the blood get all over the place? And we were kind of speculating, like, hey, maybe it's going to be that Kendall Grove fight. You know, who knows? And then the main event ends with... you know, several rounds left. So, like, hey, they're going to show us a prelim. What do they show us? The Kendall Grove fight. So, you know, I look at my friend Steve, who I'm watching, and it's like, hey, I bet the stuff's going to go down in this fight. And, I mean, it really didn't. It was, you know, not like a terrible fight. I've seen far worse, but it was certainly nothing spectacular. The rest of the prelims must have been pretty boring.
Yeah, and we never found out where that pile of blood came from.
Yeah, well, I mean, Tobin, was that one of the Spike prelims, perhaps?
You know what? He is in the bathroom right now. He is not here. Yeah, so I guess we can just pause, or you can go on with some sort of thought on it.
I don't really have a whole lot else to say about
that. Yeah, yeah. No controversy with that split decision. Yeah. Well, I was hoping he would have been back by now.
I think that's an audio choke first.
Yeah, that was almost some really good timing, you know? You were on a good roll there for a minute, and then you kind of, like, threw it to Tobin. He just wasn't there. The ghost pass.
Yeah, it's like, you know, you're playing baseball, and you get the ball, and you're like, oh, shit, that guy's running to first base. I'm going to throw it at him. And it's like, the guy's, like, looking off and waving at his mom.
The first baseman wasn't there. He's back. And now, any thoughts on this kind of underwhelming Kendall Grove match?
He won, so that was good, right? But
he did.
And I mean, Goran Relic had a top position for a lot of the fight, and just kind of goes to show that you can lose a fight even if you have top position, because he just wasn't doing anything. Kendall Grove was pretty active off of his back, but yeah, I mean, it wasn't that notable of a fight, and I think there's just some of that drama heading into it. That kind of made it more interesting. But, not a lot to say. Kendall Grove got the win. It was a split decision. And, you know, he did what he needed to do. But, just not a outstanding performance from either guy. But, you know, it's a fight, so getting the win should be good enough.
Yeah, now did we get to see the prelim on Spike TV where all the blood ended up on the mat.
That was one thing I was wondering. We did, and I'm trying to remember which. I believe that was the Ricardo Romero-Seth Petruzzelli fight. Ricardo Romero got busted up pretty bad. I think it was bleeding out of his mouth and nose, or at least one of those orifices on his face. Yeah, and it was one of those fights where you're like, yeah, so that's where all that blood came from later on.
Okay, well, that's a bit satisfying, because that was one of those things I was just mentioning while you're out there taking a pee.
I really had to. I was about to explode, I'm not going to lie.
Oh, yeah, I understand. I've been there. But I'm just saying, you know, you start a pay-per-view and there's blood all over the place. Like, yeah. Huh, wonder how that got there. And being a person who missed the Spike prelims, that really had that question in me. Like, I wonder if that was something that somebody else saw. So it's good to know. That really satisfies me knowing whose blood that was.
Yes, mystery solved.
Dun, dun, dun.
And,
mystery team.
Exactly. Can I have that DVD back, by the way?
No, I haven't watched it. I haven't watched the commentary yet.
You're holding out on me.
I'm scratching it.
I'm sending mobsters to your house. You're overdue. Anyways, we did see it on the pay-per-view, but it was a prelim fight. David Branch getting his head bashed directly into the canvas from Gerald Harris. I don't know why I said Gerald. That seems like 17th century England.
You're just so prim and proper.
I guess, yeah. Gerald Harris, really very impressive KO slam on Dave Branch. You know, he got his head back in the position, then just dropped him. Dave Branch was basically jumping to guard before they'd gotten down, and Gerald Harris would have none of it.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that they showed us the Kendall Grove fight instead of that one on the pay-per-view because...
That was on the prelims. I apologize. It was the extra fight we got on the prelims, yeah.
Oh, so there was an extra fight. Well, I guess that makes sense with the Brendan Schaub fight going so quickly.
Yeah.
So it wasn't completely unaired, but for the people who missed the spike, they missed that one then, huh?
Yeah, and it was a very impressive. It might have gotten...
You get KO of the night.
Yeah, I got KO of the night, and I mean, it was...
Any other KOs, was there?
There was, yeah, no, just a couple TKOs and stuff. I think the issue there is that it was in the third round, so they couldn't really squeeze it in. But, yeah, it was weird that the Kendall Grove went the distance with Goran Relic, and they put that on the pay-per-view. But whatever, no, it was very, very impressive from Gerald Harris, though. Nice slam. None of this, you know, it was, he put him in position and slammed him. None of this dramatic running across the mat and slamming. It was, he got his forearm up into his David Branch's face, to really get it, tilt his head back a bit, and then slammed him. So there was no question that his head was going on the mat, and he was out immediately.
So like, it was the Tito Ortiz style slam, not say the Matt Hughes style on Frank Trigg, where I'm gonna run clear across this cage and then throw him.
Right, right. None of that. And it was pretty. I guess comical moment with Gerald Harris, after he slammed him down, went to punch him and then realized he was totally clean knocked out. And so he just kind of got up, washed his hands of the whole situation and, let it be, which was
that's cool.
Nice of him. Nice to see the, no unanswered shots, to a downed opponent, that sort of thing. So.
Yeah. Well, when the guy's out, he's out.
Yeah.
If a guy's rocked, keep hitting him until the ref pulls you off him. But if he's sawing some wood, get off. Why not?
Yeah, exactly. And, this is a highlight reel win for Gerald Harris. And, it's, he's his third win in the UFC. Got wins over John Salter, Mario Miranda within this last year, his first fight in the UFC, first win was in January, then fought again in March, and then just picking up this one. So, maybe we'll see him in a televised feature, purposefully, not just like fit it in when time allows, but pretty impressive.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, that's a name that I've kind of heard, but I've never actually seen him in action. I don't actually even honestly know what it looks like at this point. So, 3-0 in the UFC, you deserve your shot on TV at least, and especially if you got a nice highlight reel slam, why the hell not? You give him a step up in competition, because really the three guys that he's fought at this point don't really have any name value either. So give him a step up and see what he can do there.
Yeah, exactly. And he's finished all of his fights, so the UFC is usually a big fan of that as well. So perhaps, in the next couple months, we'll see Gerald Harris, you know, make that step up in competition. I mean, he is 17-2 overall. He's been around for a while, but you know, just as far as UFC notoriety goes, pretty new to the UFC fans.
Well, hopefully, he can make it on like a fight night card in September or October or something. Mm-hmm. Get a 4 or 5 fight year in.
Yeah, that'd be pretty impressive. I mean, just kind of looking at his record, it looks like he stays pretty active, works in 3-4 fights a year over the past several years at least. So we'll see. But yeah, I mean, provided he has no injuries, anything like that, wouldn't be surprised to see him back in action here shortly. But I think that was about it for the UFC 116 card. It was a pretty busy night, exciting night. I think it always helps when the main event delivers the fireworks that people want, and it was very dramatic with Brock Lesnar's weathering of the storm and all of that. So I think it left fans pretty satisfied. You know.
Oh, definitely. I mean, this was up and down, at least as far as the pay-per-view portion was concerned, because once again, can't comment on anything else. But you know, as far as the 3 hours that I watched, hot damn, you know, that was a good card. It was a great night of fights. Once again, you know, I was extremely pleased with the way the Chris Leben Akiyama fight went. The Chris Lytle Matt Brown fight was extremely entertaining, as was the Kurt Pellegrino against George Sautteropoulos. The main event had you on the edge of your seat the whole time. You know, what more can you ask for?
Yeah, indeed, not much. So yeah, it's crazy, and this kind of caps off a rather busy past few months of MMA action. You know, it's kind of more, July is pretty sparse as far as, you know, big name MMA events. There's a Dream Card this next weekend, and then there's a Strikeforce Challengers, you know, toward the end of the month, July 23rd. But, you know, there's no more UFC until, you know, August. Bellator Season 2 just wrapped up. Season 3 begins in August as well.
How long does a Bellator thing go? Like, is the seasons round by round?
It's several months.
Okay, that's how they split up the seasons, is like the first round?
No, it's they do a full tournament, and then the tournament winner gets to fight the champion, and that fight takes place in the next season.
Mm.
So,
yeah, it's ridiculous. I don't care about Bellator, man.
It's working its way up, though. It's working its way up. But, I mean, just like for the amount of MMA fans have had access to over the past few months, you know, it's few and far between over this next month at least, but, you know, which is... maybe nice for us. We'll get to talk kind of more like, you know, in abstract terms about MMA, as opposed to having to be like break down cards and then preview cards. We can just kind of talk about, you know, what's going on with, you know, news, that sort of thing. A welcome reprieve, perhaps, for us. Take a breath.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think we had an episode like that once before where there was, you know, nothing that had just ended and nothing that was just starting.
And it was our first hour-long podcast.
Yeah, we just kind of went freeform, and it was fun. Yeah. I'd like to do that again sometime. If we do that twice a year, then it'll certainly be rare enough that it'll be pretty welcome.
Yeah, I can't wait next week when we go crazy about the potential Dave Bautista in Strikeforce again.
Yeah.
Or whatever else crazy is happening.
He was drunk. He doesn't know what he was saying.
Yeah. So, who knows? I mean, speaking of, I mean, have you guys been keeping up with any outlandish or out of the ordinary MMA news? I don't know. I've been pretty caught up in just the UFC 116, you know, kind of hangover. So
I haven't really followed any random stuff so much, but I have been following a little bit of Strikeforce, Fedor, Verdum, Overeem drama. That's been pissing me off.
Really? What's up?
And that is that Scott Coker is already kind of talking about having Fedor fight Overeem.
Huh.
What the hell?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny once when you have a championship match that involves a guy's coming off of a loss, but twice in a row seems kind of silly. And clearly they were building towards the Fedor-Overeem fight. Everyone assumed Fedor was going to beat Verdum, but it didn't happen. I think you got to roll with the punches on that and, you know, do something else, whether it's that immediate rematch between Fedor and Verdum or Verdum versus Overeem. But, yeah, that... I mean, as a fan, that's still a fight I'd like to see, but as far as doing it right now, it just seems kind of silly, you know, especially when one guy's a belt holder, you know, and we can debate the legitimacy of, you know, belts in Strikeforce and all of that all we want, but yeah, that does seem pretty odd.
Well, my deal is if you give Verdum a fight against Alistair Overeem, once that fight is done, you can no longer debate the legitimacy of that belt. You can't do it anymore because... Right. The number one contender Frazier will have fought the champion. Whether or not Overeem deserves the title right now, if he beats Verdum, he deserves it because he beat the guy who beat the number one heavyweight in the world. Fedor is no longer the number one heavyweight in the world. That's pretty much de facto Brock Lesnar at this point.
Yeah.
But whether or not you want to concede that, because there's all kinds of fanboys out there who you know, don't want to concede that.
Fedor for life. Reason. No.
Yeah. I mean, because Brock Lesnar is a pretty hated figure, even though he was much nicer in this last interview.
Mm.
But just what he represents. But either way, you know, you can't have a number one contendership match and then give the loser the title shot when the winner's not injured.
Yeah.
I mean, this has happened before, but it was always because the winner was injured. The thing that pops out of my head right now is when Arlovski fought Justin Eilers in the UFC. But that's because Paul Bontello was injured. And Bontello had just beaten Eilers by knockout. But Bontello got injured, and then that fight happened a few months later. So Eilers got the title shot. But Verdum is ready to go. Verdum wants Fedor. I think that's kind of a dumb match to put up together anyways. For, you know, mostly because of M1 Global. If it wasn't for M1, you know, if it was just Fedor and Fedor was a strike force fighter like anyone else was, I would feel differently about putting together the Fedor-Verdum fight. But, you know, he's the guy who just lost all of his negotiating power. He's, you know, he's still probably the best fighter in the world, even if he's not number one. He's still quite possibly the best. He could still probably beat just about anybody. But, you know, he's got one fight on his contract. Once again, he'll be a free agent then. He just lost all kinds of negotiating power because he lost, whether it's a fluke or whether it was skill. He lost. The guy who was under contract with you is the guy who legitimately deserves the title shot. Let the guy who's under contract with you fight for the title. Furthermore, that's a rematch. Your current champion has in the past lost to the guy who just beat Fedor. That's a huge revenge angle for, you know, getting some good ratings, whether it's, a fight that's put on CBS, whether it's a fight on Showtime, whether it's a fight that they want to put on pay-per-view, make it their first, Strikeforce pay-per-view. To give Fedor a fight off of a loss, it just seems ridiculous in a ranking standpoint. Yeah, as a fan, it's a fight that I would be interested in seeing. It was a fight I was expecting to see. But as far as like what Scott Coker should be doing to run a successful business, it just seems ridiculous to me. Once Fedor holds the title, any leverage that he just lost by losing his aura of invisibility, he just got twice as much of by being your current champion if he manages to beat Overeem. It just strikes me as being the worst business decision I've ever heard.
Yeah, it does seem odd. I mean, certainly there's case to be made for the rematch between Fedor and Verdum, but like, yeah, just the really of all the options, Overeem and Fedor right now just seems like the least, the one that makes the least amount of sense. And you mentioned Fedor having one more fight on his contract. And if it was any other fighter, you know, someone not involved with M1, that you don't think that would be as big of an issue. But for Fedor and M1, you know, they've definitely been willing to go into free agency pretty quickly after their contract is up. So, you know, there's no, I mean, nothing's guaranteed, but there's no like, even, you know, like, strong feeling or anything like that that, you know, Fedor will necessarily stick around with in Strikeforce after his next fight. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's a weird, weird place they're at, and hopefully it gets ironed out. And, you know, I think part of the issue is that Verdum basically, you know, said he wanted to fight Fedor immediately after beating him and basically said he was not interested in an Overeem fight, which, you know, it seems like Strikeforce has had some issues with their fighters kind of torpedoing their plans, you know, and hopefully they can get a handle on that. It just seems like, you know, we get on the UFC for being kind of overbearing and, you know, kind of trying to run fighters' lives, but at a certain point you do got to, you know, make sure fighters fight.
Exactly. You know, I'm not really one to criticize the way the UFC does things. A lot of people out there do, and, you know, they certainly have a case to be made in a lot of situations. One that really stands out to me is when the American Kickboxing Academy guys were wanting to be on the UFC video game, and like Dana White briefly fired John Fitch.
Yeah.
You know, like that's a thing where I can, you know, I can legitimately criticize the UFC. But when they want fighters to fight, and they want fighters to fight guys that they don't want to fight, and they make them do it, like, you know what, like, that's your job. I wouldn't want to fight Matt, but if I was being paid good money to do it, and my boss told me to do it, okay, you know, like.
If I'm getting paid too, yeah, you know.
Yeah, yeah. You know, if that's our job.
Tobin hires you to come kick my ass and then get his Mystery Team DVD back.
Yeah.
Well, that might be another story. But if we're both getting paid, and you know, it's all good in the hood, why not? You know, like that's my job. That's your job. Yeah. I mean, what the hell? But Strikeforce really seems to be pussyfooting their way around a lot of things, which is really disappointing to me. You know, Scott Coker has really had a great reputation for being a very good businessman, for building a business up very conservatively, which it sounds like he has done in the past. And he's still being conservative, but I would argue that he's being over-conservative in a lot of ways, and he's really getting walked over by people who are used to dealing with a guy that, you know, is brash and obnoxious. You know, there's all kinds of descriptive words that you can use on Dana White that aren't necessarily pleasant, but, you know, it's effective.
Yeah.
And, you know, Dana White's results, whether or not you like him. And I really think Scott Coker needs to kind of look in that direction, because right now, I mean, if he gives Fedor this fight, as much as, like, it's the fight that was expected to happen, it really makes his heavyweight belt look ridiculous. I mean, even more so than it already does, because it's looked ridiculous for as long as Strikeforce has been on the map. You know, Strikeforce has only been on the map since Fedor's been in Strikeforce. They've been around, but they haven't been the number two organization since then. But, you know, it's just going to make it that much worse. Like, how do you get a title shot in Strikeforce? Lose a fight. They'll give you a belt. You know? I mean, at this point, that's basically what you got to do. Brett Rogers, you know, put on a good fight against Fedor, but he lost, and then he got the title shot, and that made sense because Fedor was being, you know, Fedor and wasn't fighting Overeem for, you know, various reasons, mostly related to. But to do it twice in a row, at this point, you're establishing a pattern, you know, there's a precedent. Winning fights doesn't necessarily mean anything, it's more about your name. And, you know, at that point, it's almost wrestling.
Yeah, it is pretty crazy. I mean, they definitely need to be kind of like, you know, you mentioned that they just haven't, their name hasn't been out there for that long, so they should definitely be building towards, you know, building credible champions, building credible belts, you know, so they kind of have that history at some point down the line. And if this is where they're going with it, it's kind of questionable. And granted, the heavyweight division in MMA is kind of, you know, it's all never been the deepest division, but still, I mean, in the UFC and as well as, you know, in Strikeforce, there's several good fighters, you know, and they've got an opportunity here to kind of build towards, you know, having a legit belt. And yeah, it's just really, it's really odd. And I think in Strikeforce particularly, it's really magnified because of that lack of depth, you know, in the organization as a whole. You know, some of their divisions, like middleweight's pretty solid there, and you know, lightweight's not too bad. But yeah, especially the heavyweight division, you just got one, two, or three fighters, and then after that, it's kind of, you know, looking for scraps, that sort of thing. And so I think any time an issue like this comes out, it really just becomes a big problem. Where the UFC, they can ignore, you know, the AKA guys all they want, you know, because there's plenty of other up-and-comers, other contenders that they can put into the spot, you know, to fight, you know, at welterweight, whereas, you know, you don't have that luxury, you know, in Strikeforce, where, you know, you can kind of, you know, like, oh, this guy doesn't want to fight this guy, well, we just will make them never fight for a championship again, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And you can't really, Strikeforce just can't really do that at this point with who they have on their roster, and it's kind of unfortunate for them that so many fighters seem unwilling to, you know, engage in fights where they Strikeforce needs them to be.
Yeah, it's really a bummer. I mean, if I was Scott Coker, in terms of the heavyweight division right now, you know, give Overeem the fight against Verdum, and give Fedor, you know, like give him Antonio Silva.
Yeah.
Something like that. Because that's not a dangerous fight for him. If Fedor wins, big deal, you know. Like, you know, he can win that fight and leave, and there is no damage done, because that's a fight that he should have won. But if he goes in there and wins your belt and leaves, you know, how silly does that make you look?
Yeah. Well, ask Jake Shields, I guess.
Yeah, but at least Jake Shields was expected to lose and then leave and ended up spoiling the plans.
Yeah.
If Fedor fought Overeem, even now, Fedor would still be the favorite.
Yeah.
Like, in terms of the hardcore fans, in terms of the casual fan who doesn't really know too much about him, may have only seen him in two fights, Britt Rogers and Verdum, and thinks, well, hey, he's 1-1, you know. As far as I know, you know, that's all he's done. They might think that, you know, Overeem would be a favorite. But in terms of the people who really know what they're talking about,
yeah,
Fedor is going to be the favorite in that fight. I would put money on Fedor at even odds. You know, that would be a fight that Fedor should win. And then, you know, once again, with M1 Global, who knows where he's going to be a year from now?
King
who
of the
knows?
Cage.
Yeah. And, you know, you say that, but that's very much a possibility.
Yeah, it will be M1 Global presents King of the Cage, but yes, he who knows?
Yeah, and that's not funny, because it's very possible.
Indeed it is. Humor is a coping mechanism, and sometimes I just can't process the crazy possibilities we have in mixed martial arts, especially with M1 Global.
If you're not laughing, you're crying.
Fedor, as a fighter, I think is fantastic as a fighter. I love him as a fighter, and, you know, even, like, you know, watching him lose and, you know, just his post-fight, like, he who does not fall cannot stand back up. You know, that's some great stuff right there. But I hate him as a guy who's negotiating for a fight. And I know he has no part of it. It's all M1 Globe. It's all that name, Finkelstein guy. But, you know, just, like, if I was an organizer, if I was the guy promoting a show, I wouldn't have any part of him. Just because while he doesn't have legitimacy to your show, he also kind of eats your show at the same time.
Yeah.
And, you know, for him to be put into a position where he's got power when you just took the power away from him is crazy to me. It's crazy.
I agree. So, well, it sounds like Greg's pulled out most of his hair, as has Dana White, over the Fedor situation.
Oh, Dana White didn't have any hair to begin with, but I think he's been laughing his way to the bank this whole time.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, just like the past several weeks, what's happened in the heavyweight division has been pretty crazy, and it is just so, I mean, it really is kind of astounding to me as someone who watched, you know, You mentioned it earlier, Justin Eilers, you know, fighting Andre Arlovsky, and just kind of like the dark ages for the UFC heavyweight division, or the heavyweight general division in general for MMA, and just to see where we are now, it's just, you know, it's pretty insane, the amount of talent, and it's still not a deep division, but the so much more talent is available at heavyweight now, and much more well-rounded talent,
yeah,
as well.
Well, while it's not the deepest division, it's quite possibly the most exciting division when you look in terms of future matchups.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you look at most divisions and the champs look pretty dominant, or, you know, it's the case of the lightweight division where it's like the dominant champ got recently dethroned in an extremely close matchup, so that the most exciting matchup is the next matchup where it's like the champ against the guy who, you know, may have fluked out or may have earned that, you know. But heavyweight is like a year from now, who knows what's going to be the champion? You know, there's three or four guys who could very legitimately be the champion a year from now. I mean, a week ago it was five guys. Shane Carwin just got knocked off the block. But, you know, he could still be the champion, say, 2 years from now. If he bounces back from this fight nicely, who knows where he could be in the future. He could be right back into things. But there's Cain Velasquez, there's Junior Dos Santos, there's Roy Nelson. All those guys have a legit shot. None of those guys are a guy that people are thinking the current champ is going to just completely walk over. Like, people think that, you know, Alistair, or Silva, sorry, or George St. Pierre, who's going to walk over most of their challengers. You know, Brock Lesnar's going to have to fight for every win that he gets. But also, you know, think back to 3 years ago when Randy Couture was fresh off his win of Tim Sylvia.
Hmm.
Who would have thought that Brock Lesnar, a guy who was famous for being in the WWE.
Did we just lose Greg?
Oh no. He was on a really good roll there, too.
He was having deep thoughts.
Oh, man.
Is what that was.
Oh.
I was about to ask him if he thought heavyweight was going to be the new light heavyweight division, because that light heavyweight seemed to be like the division where there's so many possibilities and there's never like a champ that stayed around for too long, and because there's always just a strength of you know, really deep well to go to when it came to competitors. And then... Greg was on a roll, and
and I was text messaging this girl, and then that's all out the window now.
Great, our producer is text messaging. No wonder we lost Greg.
Producer works. I'm certainly not adding much else to the podcast.
What else should we call you?
No, master of ceremonies, I guess.
The mustachioed master of ceremonies.
Look at that mustache.
Do you think he knows he got disconnected? Or
no, and Greg, probably not.
Yeah, what's up?
Hey.
So go on. What you were saying?
Man, where was I when I got lost?
You were on a roll. It
you were really getting in there,
dude.
Yeah. We don't really know. We just
we're talking about the craziness of the heavyweight division and how, like, you know, in a next year, who knows who would be champion. And, you know, just kind of going back about, you know, like, the history of the division, you know, like, you know, you mentioned, you know, Randy Couture, you know, having that win over Tim Sylvia and then facing Brock Lesnar.
Okay, so 3 years ago, when Randy Couture was fresh off his win, Tim Sylvia was getting ready to fight Gabriel Gonzaga for beating Crow Cop, who would have thought that a guy like Brock Lesnar, who was famous for his time in the WWE, was 0-0, I think, in MMA, would not only be the... UFC heavyweight champion, but at this point, I believe, is tied for the most defenses of a heavyweight champion in UFC history at 2 defenses. I mean, if he wins his fight against Cain Velasquez, he is officially the greatest heavyweight champion in the history of the UFC. And even Fedor, I think, only has 3 title defenses in Pride. So one fight after that, I mean, if he can beat Cain Velasquez and the winner of Junior Dos Santos against... Roy Nelson, if he can win those next 2 fights, Brock Lesnar is officially the greatest heavyweight champion in the history of the sport.
Yeah, that's just crazy. I mean, I think it speaks a lot to, like, the talent that's there now. I mean, because, you know, we talk about Fedor's career and stuff, and, you know, even though he's lost, he's still, like, probably the best heavyweight just because of his accomplishments. But, you know, I mean, if you look at how many fights he had against good fighters and how few and far those were between, you know, it'd be a year or so, you know, between really high-level fights at least. And, you know, Brock Lesnar doesn't have that, you know, doesn't have that luxury, I guess, is a way to put it, you know. Or anyone in the top tier of the heavyweight division. There's no easy fight. There's no, like, you know, no-name Japanese heavyweight for him to punt across the ring before he fights another top contender, you know.
So, yeah, well, I mean, Pride was the host to all kinds of fun fights.
Yeah.
I'm not going to bash on Pride in terms of entertainment value, but in terms of being a sport. I mean, Pride was kind of like the halfway point between mixed martial arts and pro wrestling. It was certainly, like, for the most part, real. There were all kinds of rumors about various fights being works, and I'm not going to get into that. But just, like, they wanted their guys to fight on a frequent basis. I mean, you had guys like Josh Barnett and Crow Cop fighting 6 times a year sometimes. And that's unheard of in the UFC. But half the guys they fought sucked.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't want to diss on Japanese mixed martial artists, but, you know, in Pride, you would fight against big names based on being a Japanese guy, basically. And, you know, it'd be the same as us giving, you know, a fight against a guy like Shogun or George St. Pierre, a foreign champion, because you're an American. I understand where they're coming from. But these guys would be completely undeserving of some shots and would get these fights against these big names and would just get creamed as a result of that. I mean, just look at Vanderlei Silva's list if you want to see a bunch of names that you've never heard of before.
Right, I mean, that's where a lot of those highlight reel knockouts from Krokop or Wanderlei Silva or Fedor or, you know, any number of guys who fought in Pride, you know, they have this, you know, storied career and they fought some very good competition, but a lot of, like, the actual highlights, the images people have of them just trouncing guys are usually against people no one's ever heard of. Unless you're Wanderlei Silva, then you have those two death punches or death strikes on a Rampage Jackson to your credit. So.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing. Like, all these guys who are the huge, huge names in Pride, they all have some legit wins. It's not like they all are against guys. It's like, you know, Wanderlei Silva beat Rampage twice. Krokop has a number of good wins. He beat Josh Rennett three times, although really only two of them count. There's one of them, Josh Rennett injured himself on a takedown.
Yeah.
Kind of a freak accident thing. Fedor beat Nogueira twice and Krokop. You know, all these guys have legit wins. But people like to talk about how, you know, Fedor is 30-1, essentially now. He's 30-2, but, you know, it's really hard to count that Tsuyoshi Kusaka fight.
Yeah.
So, you know, you want to call him 30-1. But really, do 30 of those wins count? You know, if you actually go on to Sherdog Fight Finder and look at the guys that Fedor has fought, you know, there are some outstanding wins there. He now has wins over, I think, three UFC champions in Nogueira, Tim Sylvia, and Andrei Arlovski.
Yeah.
You know, he's fought some fantastic fighters, but he's also fought a lot of guys who completely suck. And, you know, his thing, more than anything else, was that he was consistent.
Yeah.
You know, Krokop stepped on his dick a few times. You know, he lost to Kevin Randleman. He lost to Mark Hunt. He lost to guys that he didn't belong losing to. Wanderlei Silva was also pretty consistent, but towards the end of his Pride time, he fought some guys who just were, they overmatched him. He fought Krokop, and then he fought Dan Henderson, which was, you know, a pretty legit fight, and he ended up being on the losing end of that one. But, you know, these guys who were the longtime Pride champions, it's not so much that they don't deserve their place in history, because they do. They certainly went out there and they won some fights. But if you just look at their statistics, that's what's inflated. They just got more wins than they deserve in terms of, you know, the Pride versus UFC guy. Because while they have all these wins, maybe half of them are wins that they would have gotten in the UFC, because they would have only fought half as much, but they wouldn't have fought the guys that didn't belong in the ring with them.
Right, it's a consistency issue, and that's where I kind of go back to my thing about, you know, anyone in the heavyweight division, you know, in the UFC, or you can even make the argument in Strikeforce or any legit heavyweight division now, if you can show any type of dominance for just like a couple of years, like your resume is just going to be huge as far as relevance goes, because there just aren't those in-between fights anymore. There shouldn't be, you know. There's not going to be. I mean, you know, everyone talks about Brock Lesnar still being inexperienced. You know, he's 5-1, but you know he's fought, you know, some of the top, you know, guys in his division already. You know, he's, you know, Shane Carwin, Frank Mir, Randy Couture, Heath Herring, and you know, those are all legit heavyweights, or were at the time when he fought them to a certain extent. And you know, there's not a, you know, his first fight is against someone no one had really heard of, and that was it. You know, so if anyone can kind of pull off any amount of extended success, I guess at any weight division at this point, I guess the heavyweight was kind of the last division to kind of come around, you know, where it really is a feat to be kind of like marveled at in this day and age now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and like we were kind of both saying, heavyweight is really the only division where there's never really been a huge streak.
Yeah.
There's been so many champions. I mean, you look at the UFC history where, I mean, the heavyweight title has just bounced around so many times. There's been very few people that have held it for much longer than a year. And then in Pride, there was only two heavyweight champions, but they only had a couple defenses each. Just because there were so many non-title fights, there were so many times where they fought people who didn't belong there, and even guys that did belong there, you know, maybe the fight was in a tournament. You know, they had the Grand Prix, which would mess things up. The UFC doesn't play with that kind of stuff. They make every fight count. There are no easy fights nowadays. So, you know, if you're the champion, and, you know, I don't envy Brock's position. He's the biggest target on his back in the world right now, and he's only had 6 fights. He got that target after his 4th fight. That's ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah. He's the champion of a division that it's the best it's ever been, and I would assume it's only going to get more difficult for him to be able to thrive in that environment. And we'll see. Before we got disconnected that first time, I was going to ask you, do you think heavyweight's become the new light heavyweight division in the, just kind of the, I guess part of it is the amount of contenders there are and just the, flux it's been in, and certainly Lesnar's actually defended several times now, so he might be a solid champ, but it seems, for a while it was the light heavyweight division where, first of all, the UFC was really well known and well respected for, this is the most exciting division, this is the big name division. Do you think that mantle is almost being passed over perhaps to the heavyweight division now where we have a steady line of top-quality contenders, waiting for a shot at the champion, and it's very possible that we could have a new champ, every several, 4 or 5 months at this rate, potentially?
Well, if you want to look at it on a historical point of view, I would almost say that the two divisions have done a complete flip-flop. Historically, you've had guys at light heavyweight or even middleweight, if you go back far enough. Frank Shamrock had the belt that is now called the lightweight belt. It was middleweight at the time, but it was 200 pounds was the weight limit. So that's closer to light heavyweight than it is to middleweight. And
yeah.
Even, Tito Ortiz was the last middleweight before they came to the new system. So, Frank Shamrock held that belt and defended it, I think, 4 times. Tito Ortiz then got it and defended it 5 times. Randy Couture got it briefly, and he kind of had that little snafu with Vitor Belfort where he lost it on a cut and won it back and then lost Chuck Liddell, who went on to defend it 5 times. The light heavyweight belt has always been about dominant champions. It's always been about name value. You get a guy who's a poster boy for the UFC. Frank Shamrock was the poster boy kind of in the wrong time, historically speaking. It sucks for him, but that's just kind of the way the things went down. He was the poster boy for the UFC when the UFC, wasn't on even pay-per-view. You couldn't order the pay-per-views. Then Tito Ortiz has his time to shine when the UFC is first coming back into mainstream. It's not the big leagues yet, but it's it's making its comeback. And then Chuck Liddell had his big reign where he is quite possibly the biggest name in the sport. But it's been all about these big champions. And then you look at what happened since Chuck Liddell lost. Rampage won, and he had 1 successful title defense. He actually held the belt for 1.5 years, but that was only because he didn't defend it for an entire year. And then the belt has basically changed every 6 months since then, every time it was defended. The one time it didn't change hands was the first time Machida fought Shogun, where it should have changed hands, it just didn't because the judges were dumb. And the heavyweight belt, on the other hand, has had such a turbulent history. There's been so many heavyweight champions in the history of the UFC, going back to Mark Coleman. Which was, around the same time that Frank Shamrock was holding the belt. And if you wanted to name every heavyweight champion in the UFC, that would take like a minute. And, I pretty much just rattled off almost every name of the light heavyweight championship up until 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But now you've got Brock Lesnar, who seems unstoppable. I don't want to say that he is. Everyone's human, and he certainly he looked human in the first round of that last fight. But he's now a legit champion. He's not only defended his belt, he's defended it twice, both times by finish. And I would expect him to successfully defend his belt the next time. I've been wrong before, but I think the case could be made that both these weight divisions have kind of done the 180, where the lightweight belt just nobody seems to be able to hold onto it. And even now, Shogun, who looks back in form, he was the number one light heavyweight fighter 5 years ago. He was injured. He was out for a long time. People said he was done, and then he came back and he beat Machida in a fight that nobody expected him to win. And now he's got knee injuries again.
Yeah, he's out for the rest of the year, it sounds like. So.
Yeah, but you know, who knows how he's going to come back from that. I could see how the Shogun that fought Machida at UFC 113 is way better than Rashad Evans that beat Rampage at UFC 114, but is he going to be better when they fight next time? You know, who knows? You know, if he has a knee injury, is he going to be able to run on that treadmill, get that cardio? Who knows? You know, maybe that belt changes hands once again. And I could very much see it happening. That's become a very turbulent weight class. While the heavyweight is all of a sudden, while it's exciting, it's very different. There's all kinds of contenders. There's all kinds of matches that people want to see. It's been consistent also,
yeah,
which is unusual.
Yeah, indeed. So, the only thing I had, thoughts to add to that was just mentioning the light heavyweight division, you know, with Shogun being out. I mean, it's kind of, it really is up in the air for light heavyweights now what they're going to do. I mean, if he's out for until next year, I mean, do we see another interim belt at light heavyweight? I mean, and that's kind of, I mean, that still causes a bit of a mess, but it is weird to have, for a division that was so long dominated by, you know, one guy, and over the past few years it's been a lot more turbulent. You know, it's interesting to see where it's going to go going forward, and, you know, it sucks, obviously, for Shogun having that another knee injury, but I don't know. I mean, a lot of the top guys have all taken bad losses recently. You know, Rich Franklin's working his way back into the picture at 205, but it's just it's a really crazy division, and, yeah, I kind of agree that the heavyweight division at least has the potential to be a more stable division. I'm not going to go out on the limb and say that it will be, but it's definitely, the potential is there. So,
yeah. I mean, I'm not going to say that, like, it's going to be super stable, because heavyweight does have that thing where everyone has one punch knockout ability.
Mm-hmm.
Whether, you know, like, some people have it more than others, obviously. You know, Shane Carwin probably has it more than Cain Velasquez. You know, Junior Dos Santos probably has it more than Brock Lesnar. But everyone can put everyone away. And when you've got a situation like that, it's not like in lighter divisions where you necessarily have to be the best guy to win. You have to be the guy who landed the first shot.
Yeah.
Which really makes things more interesting. I mean, I love to watch me lightweight fights because they're high-paced. They're really exciting in terms of, like, stuff going on. Those little guys will beat each other into hamburger. But at heavyweight, you never know what's going to happen until you've seen it. Granted, a heavyweight fight that goes into the second or third round all of a sudden loses a lot of interest. But a heavyweight fight that hasn't happened yet, you have no idea, just because, you know, even a guy who should have the disadvantage on his feet can get that knockout, because really all he needs to do is land one or two more punches.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, on that note, I'm out of things to talk about, but it's definitely an interesting time for the UFC going forward in multiple divisions. And, you know, I am looking forward to have a little bit of time to
reflect,
to rest and reflect, and not have to worry about all the fights coming up or all the fights that just happened.
Well, this has just been, you know, insane these past few months of all the mixed martial arting that's been going on. And it's been the best time to be into mixed martial arts and to be following it, you know, a lot of, probably not since, you know, the birth of the UFC have things been this good in a case where anything has happened and worlds have been rocked pretty consistently over the past few months.
Yeah, well, I mean, there was 2007, which is kind of labeled by the hardcore fans as being the year of the upset.
Mm.
That was the year that Pride died. And a lot of their fighters made their way over to the UFC. But I've always kind of considered that to be the fact that people kind of overrated, I think, Pride fighters. Once again, kind of going back to what I was saying about how they had a lot of fighters that didn't belong in the cage with them. And people really kind of found out that UFC fighters were comparable to Pride fighters, which before that people were really kind of considering, you know. I mean, there were all kinds of people on the Internet saying that a guy like Heath Herring would come in and win the UFC championship. Which turned out to not be the case at all. So, I mean, that was a pretty exciting time, too, when the UFC bought out Pride and got a lot of these fighters. They bought the WFA and got Rampage.
3 years ago.
Yeah. Well, I mean, now it is exciting on a different note. We've got a show basically every other week to talk about, which is awesome. And there's some people that complain about cards being watered down too much, but as far as I'm concerned, the more mixed martial arts, the better. You know, I would rather see up-and-comers than see a guy get a title shot and not know who he is. You know, like, if you see a guy work his way up, that's really awesome. 5 years ago, we wouldn't know who George Satoropoulos is. He would just be a guy who's, you know, gotten a handful of wins. And, you know, there's so many guys that have gotten a handful of wins. But we've gotten to see these guys, you know, go from being an unknown to being a guy that we're excited about getting a title shot, because we now get the opportunity to see guys on their way up. When, you know, the UFC only did 5 cards a year, you didn't really get to see that. Guys on their way up would be on the prelim, if they're in the UFC at all.
Mm-hmm.
Back then, they only had room for guys who were basically main eventers. So, you know, do you get less for your money now than you did back then? Yeah, probably. You get the same amount of fights, just less name value. But, you know, I love to see the people working their way into contention. I love to see the people who rise to the challenge and who fall along the way. And, you know, I agree with you. It's probably the best time to date to be a fan of the sport.
Hooray.
All right, cool. Well, until next time, Audio Chokers, thank you. We're on Twitter. Follow us, audiochoke@twitter.com. And audiochoke@facebook.com. Leave a comment. Start up a conversation here at the MMA Torch Forum. And until next time,
I'm Greg Rowan.
I'm Tobin Shelby.
I'm Matt Collins. We'll catch you later.
Audio Choke.
All right, time for naps.
Yeah, I could go for one of those.
Good.
Yeah, that was
good. Good job, Greg. You really had the fire in your belly this week.
Yeah, I've had a few glasses of wine.